This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds.
Hello, Lucy White here from BBC Scotland's Podlitico. We'll let you get back to Scotland Outdoors in just a moment. But first, I want to tell you about our podcast. We're a team of political journalists who like to unpick what's actually happening at the Scottish Parliament and Westminster. We look at all these political decisions and what they mean for you and me, and we try not to take ourselves too seriously. We have a new episode every Thursday at 6 p.m. Subscribe to Podlitical on BBC Sounds. Now back to Scotland Outdoors.
The Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Nan Shepherd's a writer from my neck of the woods, the northeast of Scotland, who shot to fame in recent years. If you haven't heard of her, you might recognise her as the face of the Scottish £5 note. It was her seminal work about the Cairngorms, the Living Mountain, that really established her as one of Scotland's finest nature writers. Now, she wrote, it's essentially a love letter, a poetic love letter to the mountains during the Second World War. But incredibly, it sat untouched in a drawer in a house near Aberdeen for over 30 years. Since its publication in the late 70s, it's captured the attention of nature enthusiasts around the globe and has now been translated into 14 languages and been the subject of umpteen other works, including theatre, TV documentaries and radio programmes. Now, we're going to be talking about a new album inspired by that book shortly. But first, joining me today is another Nan enthusiast, Helen Needham.
I think it was the work of Robert McFarland, another fine nature writer, that actually pointed me in the direction of Nan Shepherd in his book The Wild Places. And I just found it so exciting that a woman who spent her whole life just a few miles from me, about 3 miles from where I'm sitting right now, wrote in such a beautiful and poetic way about the Cairngorms, which are also mountains that I love. The Living Mountain, it's just one of those books that I go back to again and again. It's almost got an eternal quality to it, I think.
What I tend to find about it is it's one of those rare works that actually makes you look at a corner of the world in a completely different way, in a much deeper way. And our guest in this edition of the podcast is Jenny Sturgeon. Jenny's a folk singer, a songwriter and an ecologist originally from Aberdeenshire. She now lives in Shetland. She's just released a new album called The Living Mountain. Hello, Jenny. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm good, thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, well, nice to have you on the podcast. Thanks very much for taking the time. Just describe where you are. Describe Shetland.
So I sat in my neighbour's house today because we're getting some building work done in our house. Typically, the drilling started up as soon as I was about to start recording this podcast. So
obviously,
So I'm just looking out over the sea. I live in the south mainland of Shetland, and my house looks out over Leavenworth Bay, and it's quite incredible. I kind of forget sometimes just how special it is, and then when I'm chatting to people on Zoom or something, turn the camera around so they can see. It's nice to give people context of where you are, and it's a beautiful place. And we've had a number of cetaceans from our window this year, including humpback whales and Rizzo's dolphins and orca, and just one of those things. It makes it difficult to do any work, actually, to spend the day looking at the sea.
I would be hopeless at that. I love the sea. I mean, today here in rural Aberdeenshire, it's a grey day and it's kind of blowy. But, you know, it's with a seascape, that becomes much, much more interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting because I wasn't sure how I would find living in Shetland. But because I'm used to Aberdeenshire, where there's loads of trees and it's really leafy and green and big rivers, and actually coming up here, I think because the sea is changing every second, really, there's always something new to look at, and I just never get bored of it.
The landscape that Nan Shepherd's writing about essentially is the Cairngorms, you know, and those are hills that they're not terribly accessible. If you're going to climb a hill in the Cairngorms, you're going to have a long walk in the first place. They tend to be rounded, you know. In the West Coast, you stand on ground level and you look up, you get the view. In the Cairngorms, you go to the tops and you look down and you get the views. When did you first encounter the book, The Living Mountain? Are you much of a reader?
Interestingly, I'm not much of a reader, actually. I prefer podcasts. I think partly because I quite like to be doing other things at the same time, whether that's, I don't know, sitting and knitting or, I don't know, cooking, or like to be able to listen to words. But I first encountered The Living Mountain, I suppose I heard about it first of all, maybe like 10 or 15 years ago. And it was kind of rattling around in my brain, awareness of this book. And then my partner very strongly suggested that I read it. He's a big fan of the book and had gone back to it for years and said, you would love this book. And so I did actually sit down and read it and fell in love with it, really.
And for people who haven't read The Living Mountain, it's a very elemental book and focuses right in on the detail of the Cairngorms, the mountains and the environment there. What is it about it that appealed to you in particular?
I think it was being familiar with that landscape. So I grew up in Afford in Aberdeenshire, and my family, we always went on adventurous excursions around the place, like going up hills and camping. And so I was very familiar with the Cairngorm Mountains, and yeah, was brought up just 20 minutes from the Cairngorms National Park. And she was talking about something I could really connect with and understand. And I think it was really interesting as well because it changed the way that I view all landscapes. So I read the book, and then going back to it multiple times for this project, I think it really has, yeah, it's changed the way that I spend time in an environment, and whether that's the Cairngorms or up here in Shetland or anywhere. And I think that's why it translates so well across different languages and different places. You don't have to be familiar with that landscape to get a lot out of the book, because it is very elemental, like you say.
Would you mind sharing a reading with us, just to give people a sense of the work itself?
Yeah, definitely. So this was really hard to pick one out. So my copy of the book has loads of turned down pages and highlighted bits and scribbles and writings in it. And there's so many bits that stand out. I think I could almost have picked any paragraph from the book, but I ended up settling on this one from chapter 12, which is the chapter Being, which I think kind of encompasses the whole ethos and whole idea of the book. So there I lie on the plateau. Under me, the central core of fire from which was thrust this grumbling, grinding mass of plutonic rock. Over me, blue air, and between the fire of the rock and the fire of the sun, scree, soil and water, moss, grass, flower and tree, insect, bird and beast, wind, rain and snow, the total mountain. Slowly I have found my way in.
It's a lovely piece of writing. One of the great lines that she has is, you know, and it just opened part of the world up for me, was that a mountain has an inside.
Yes, yep.
And you think, wow, of course it does. Yeah. Yeah. The more you think about it, you know, the richer it gets.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what's gorgeous about her book, is that she covers all aspects of the mountain. And similar to what you were saying earlier, it does change the way you walk into hills or anywhere. Just going for a walk from my door here in Shetland, I don't necessarily anymore, well, I don't ever now look at a map and go, I'm going to take this route today, I'm going to bag this many Munros and go in this direction, and it'll take me about 8 hours and whatever. I kind of have a map with me and take all the precautions, and safety is very much still paramount, but it's kind of wandering where you want to and stopping and looking and seeing things in more detail than I probably ever have before.
Yeah. See, to me, the book is about listening, about perceiving, about, you know, different ways of actually looking. It is, therefore, in many ways, abstract. So how do you go about turning something like that into a musical work?
That is a good question. I was looking for a new project off the back of working on Northern Flyway with Inga Thompson, which was a audiovisual project inspired by bird ecology and mythology and folklore. And in that project, we used a lot of field recordings and also the live performance works with a film. So there's a continuous film of all these landscapes and birds, and it's just rich and gorgeous and kind of draws audiences in. And I think that experience made me think, oh, I want to explore using senses to engage audiences, and that visual element is really important as well. And so at the time, I was rereading The Living Mountain and was kind of struck by how perfect this book was, having that connection to that landscape anyway, and it just felt like the right sort of thing to do. So I looked at each chapter separately, first of all starting with these chapter titles, and just free wrote based on those titles. And then after that, I went back and read her chapters and kind of delved into that more deeply. But at the same time, I was also going out into the Cairngorms and collecting field recordings. So those influenced a lot of the songs as well.
To my mind, it's quite a kindly book. It shares a tremendous amount. You are going to share in turn some of the field recordings that you actually made up in the Cairngorms. This one's called Soundscape.
We recorded the album in the Cairngorms. So myself and Andy Bell, who produced and recorded the album, went up to Clashnetty Arts Centre, and we had a week there. And very early on in the process of writing the songs and developing the project, I knew I wanted field recordings to feature in the album. And so Andy and I decided it would be a great thing to put out a mic every day when we were recording outside and capture some of the actual live soundscapes from the Cairngorms National Park. We listened back to all of these and chose one that sits as a bed underneath the entire album. So it's unedited in that we haven't cut it up. 55 minutes worth of soundscape, including birds chattering and captures some of their wing movements as well, somehow, incredibly. And also we've got some sounds of the wind in the trees and the river near the house. So it's just a nice thing to listen to. It's very calming, I think.
We've touched on this already, but the Cairngorms has a very particular character, and if you want to go in there, it requires commitment. There's the long walk in. I always think it's definitely worth it when you get there. It can be truly magic. Did reading The Living Mountain make you see those mountains differently? Because you talked about the fact that you grew up close to the mountains. Having read this book and going back there, do you see them differently now?
Yeah, I think I definitely do. I've been multiple times throughout the project with various different people, including having a lovely trip up there with my dad. Well, several trips with my dad, actually. He was there when we went to go and use a hydrophone and collect the sound of different burns and lochs, and also went for a four-day camping trip with him. And that was something really special, I think, partly because I was there with him, you know, making time to have that experience away from a busy schedule and just really being in the mountains, which is what the book's about. And I took the book, and it was quite I'd never read it in the mountains before, but, you know, before bed, sitting and reading it. And I think as well, looking from a different perspective of creating this piece of work, which is not only the music, but the film and the live performance, I was kind of spending more time looking and experiencing, and like it says in the book, you know, using all of your senses and taking time. And I think that really did change the way I have seen that landscape.
Recently, I went up there because I'm actually making a programme, a radio programme, relating to this book as well. It's based on sounds of the River Dee. And I went up there and I was very lucky with the weather. It was just beautiful. There was not a breath of wind. We spent 2 days there. And I sat high up on Angel's Peak and read out loud passages from The Living Mountain describing exactly what I could see in front of me. And I felt so moved by the whole thing. I feel sometimes when I have these experiences that it just charges me up. It's like some energy that I take and it sticks with me. It's like you going with your dad, you know, it stays with you, doesn't it? Actually being in an environment like that.
There is something in that though, isn't there? I think these experiences, and no matter where it is, I think that for me anyway, because the outdoors and nature and landscape is so important, those are the things that stay with me and probably will stay with me forever. It's like those certain experiences, like you saying, Helen, about being in the Cairngorms and reading some passages aloud in that environment, will like stay with you forever. And you'll be able to remember, whenever you read that passage, you'll draw to mind that exactly where you were and the sun and the light. And there's something quite magical about that, which I think I sort of take for granted, or I have taken for granted in the past, but I think is increasingly I'm becoming more aware of that. And those are the things that are important.
One of the creatures that you can only see on the high tops, because they basically never come down from the high tops, or very, very rarely, is the ptarmigan. It's an extraordinary beastie. Just explain how it is adapted to its environment.
Well, they're incredible birds. Well, they just live up in the high mountains in the plateau all year round, which is kind of an Arctic environment, and they're just so well adapted. Their plumage turns white in the winter, and they're very well camouflaged, and they've just got incredible furry feet as well, don't they? They've got feathers on their feet, and just beautiful, beautiful birds, and they have this incredible, incredible call. And it's always a delight. I love going up to the Cairngorms and being able to see them, and occasionally you can kind of creep up on them and watch them, and they seem to just be going about their business.
Jenny, you're an ecologist as well as a musician, and I'm wondering how important the types of field recording that you're sharing with us today are to the musical work, how it informs the musical approach.
It definitely does. I think the first kind of project I did that started using field recordings was a commission for the National Trust for Scotland. I went out to St Kilda to celebrate. It was 30 years since they'd been given World Heritage Site status, and they wanted something to mark that, so they asked me to write some music, and I was lucky enough to get out there, and it was very clear that that was such an important part of that place. And I think in order to kind of transport listeners to that place, it was important to have those field recordings of the St Kilda Wren and of the wild, crazy weather in the record. And so I've sort of started doing that ever since then, really. It's just another element, I think, which kind of can draw in listeners and to me anyway, helps place that music in the landscape. And so including things like the Ptarmigan Call and various different calls in the Living Mountain record just felt like the natural and right thing to do. And it also is one of the things that I use when I'm writing or composing a piece, is I'll have these sounds around me, listening to them through headphones or however, and that helps inform the sound of the piece as well, as much as just the writing that I've done or anything. It's the sounds that I hear that transport me to that place.
The call of the crested tit, very sharp, very precise.
And such incredible little birds. One of my favourite places in the Cairngorms National Park is Abernethy Forest, and I love getting to watch the crested tits, and they're just gorgeous little things, and the way that they use their crests for signalling and just hearing them is a beautiful thing. So of course they needed to be involved in the record as well.
Another sound which is very evocative, particularly in autumn in the mountains of Scotland, is the stags roaring as the rut takes place. It can be quite unsettling, actually, if you're not used to it. It's got an almost primeval quality to it. You've got that sound, but you've taken it a step further here with a bit of artistic license and made it sound even weirder.
Well, I think for this track, the birds, animals and insects wanted it to feel a little bit, almost a bit hazy, like on one of those days when you're up in the mountains and you think that you're hearing something, but you can't tell where it's coming from. And particularly, I think that sound of the roaring deer is one of those sounds. You know, it echoes through the valleys and is a really striking sound. So yeah, we used a bit of poetic license and manipulated some of these calls. So it's a recording by a guy called Magnus Robb, who is a fantastic field recording person, and yeah, he supplied the samples of these different species.
So you got Magnus Robb's recordings of red deer there, and then we moved into the sound of snipe, but I mean it's a slightly different take on snipe drumming there.
I think this is one of my favourite sounds, along with the curlew, the snipe drumming, and they create this incredible sound through the vibration of their feathers. I think it's used, I might be wrong, I'm sure some listeners will tell me if I'm wrong, but when the birds are displaying, they create this sound, and there's something just weird and magical about it.
You know, it's weird and magical about this, Helen, that, you know that, again, the live programme that we do 2 or 3 weeks ago, we do a mystery bird every week, and it was the snipe. 2 days, well, 2 days after, you know, we did the mystery bird, the snipe, I was out walking, and two snipe came out of a flooded field in front of me, and off they went. Yesterday, for the first time, bear in mind, we've lived in this house for 27 years, and I've never seen one, even in the area. There was one in my patio, about 20 feet away from where I'm sitting at the moment. This is beginning to get a bit weird.
What are the chances? You'll have one in your house next.
Winter, the ice and snow. Is that something you're into? Because some people just love it when the snow comes and they can get in there with some skis and do some mountaineering and ice climbing and so on. Does that have any appeal to you?
Yeah, definitely. I absolutely love the snow. It's one of my favourite times a year. I suppose I've just got such fond memories of being a kid and getting 2 weeks off school every year because of the snow, which just doesn't happen anymore. That we don't get the snow in the same way. But I was brought up, I think as soon as I could walk, I was on cross-country skis, and my mum and dad would take me into the hills. And there's something so special about the view when there's snow, but also the sound. Everything's kind of that dampened sound, and I just absolutely love it. Although there's obviously an element of danger, and it can be treacherous up in the Cairngorms at that time of year, but there's so much beauty to behold in that as well, I think. And was delighted that Nan had a frost and snow chapter that I could write about. I spent quite a lot of my childhood and revisiting it in recent years, going back to cross-country skiing, which I absolutely love. It's, you know, getting out into the hills with nobody else. You know, you go with one other person, and you don't see anybody else, and you're creating your own tracks in the snow, and you come across mountain hare tracks, and You see things like ptarmigan, and I think it just totally changes the landscape as well. You can't tell where you are, which is part of the danger, or can be part of the danger. And I suppose similar to the sea in that way, it makes you realise how insignificant you are.
Snowbones creak under weight of the smallest feet. Leave a trail track and find before the fall, before the fall.
I must confess, I've got something of a love-hate relationship with social media. There's a lot of it I don't like, but one thing I do like is the occasional glimpse you get into other people's interests and passions. And for some reason on Twitter, I seem to have ended up connected to quite a few people who are interested in snow patches. You know, and this snow patch exists here and this snow patch exists there, and it's lasted till such and such, and this is the longest it's ever lasted, and, you know, so, well, there's no snow at all on this mountain. People are using this as a barometer of climate change. The work that you've just produced, the Living Mountain, does it have a wider environmental message?
I think it does. It's not explicit, perhaps, but it's a celebration of that landscape, and I suppose the fragility of it, but also the long term, you know, the mountains have been there and they'll be there after we're gone. I suppose there are elements of environmental change in there. I talk about in the birds, animals and insects how there's a reference to the ptarmigan and the mountain hare going white in winter, and whether they will adapt with climate change not to turn white, because obviously it makes them very visible to predators. So it'll be interesting. And it's interesting, but it's very unfortunate that these animals might, they're teetering on the brink anyway, and hopefully they will survive. But they're in their kind of last stronghold in the UK, in that landscape anyway. There's also mentions of grouse shooting and things like that in the album. With my music, I don't want to ram anything down anybody's throats. I think it's better for people to take what they can from the record and the words that I'm saying, and the message is maybe subtle, but hopefully it will permeate.
Coming back to Nan Shepherd, she had a particular fascination with water and the living mountain, and the Lochans and the Burns. All the stuff that comes from the mountains to form the River Dee. I dug out this quote: "Water, that strong white stuff, one of the four elemental mysteries. It is so simple that it frightens me. It wells from the rock and flows away. For unnumbered years, it has welled from the rock and flowed away. It does nothing, absolutely nothing, but be itself." Now, again, you've taken water as a theme with some recordings. There's definitely a musicality to the sound of water.
Yes, and her words in that chapter, throughout the whole book, it's like there's not a word that's out of place. Every word's almost been considered and chosen to be included or not, and the water chapter is beautiful.
Oh, Bernie, wee the glass white shiver, singing over stone.
For this song, I'd also bought her book of poetry. The first poem in that book is this poem called The Singing Burn, and I read it and thought, God, that sounds just absolutely like a song. It's in a song structure, and there's a rhyme in there, and it just reads like a song lyric, but it's only two verses long. And so I took some liberties and added some more verses to create this song.
From cold mountain springs to o'er persuade the haunted ear, it new creates the tune.
As you enter the Cairngorms, there's just some absolutely exquisite pine forest, which is again home to lots of wildlife specific to that environment. There are some wonderful trees in places like Rothie Mercus, some granny pines. What's the significance of trees within the album?
I think it's that ancientness of them, particularly with the Scots pine, the granny pines, and the Abernethy Forest is one of my favourite places in the world, I think, to go for a walk and just be in. And seeing those old trees is just, there's something magical about them. And the thought that they would have been all over the mountains at one point, I'd love to go back and see that. The book's just been fabulous, and this project for exploring all these different elements of the mountains, and from the tiny, tiny plants that you find right up in the top of the plateau to these granny pines down in Abernethy Forest. And it felt right to have the sound of some creaking trees in there. It was a sound that I wasn't able to capture myself, but I got in touch with a friend, Jez Riley French, who does incredible field recordings and takes groups up to the Cairngorms every year to do a week-long recording sessions of different elements of the Cairngorms. And he has this brilliant recording of trees creaking in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Andy did some magic in the studio and made the track pan between the left and right. So if you're listening on headphones, you can hear the trees actually creaking as they would have been in your ears. We are.
I find the book fascinating because it works, I think, because Nan Shepherd approached the environment like a lover. You know, she basically just tried to surrender, to subsume herself, you know, to the environment. You know, she was saying, right, take me out of this. What am I actually perceiving? What am I feeling? What are the connections here? And she just does it so beautifully. And you said it earlier that it's a very Aberdonian book. It's very spare. There's no frills or nothing fancy about it. It's just saying this is, you know, and it is enough in and of itself.
And the other thing I love about it and her writing is she doesn't make it about herself. It is about the mountains. It's her experiences in the mountains, but there's no ego in it at all, or not. I can't see any ego in it. And I think that's so refreshing as well, especially in some of this kind of more exploratory nature writing. Although I think a lot of writing is going that way now, but for a while it was more about conquering a mountain. It's like mountains are not there to be conquered. They kind of let us in. It's just a perfect little book, really.
There's a fascination with mountains the world over, which is probably why this book, The Living Mountain, has been translated into so many languages now. Places like Japan spring to mind, where there are holy mountains that are still revered today. The Living Mountain, it's a very spiritual book. How much of that was important to you? I know we've talked a bit about it already, but in the spiritual sense rather than the environmental sense.
I think the two things go sort of hand in hand, the spiritual and the environmental, or they do to me anyway. That seems like that's my form of religion, the outdoors. And the spirituality is throughout the whole book. And I think in that regard, I was quite keen to take on that philosophy for the album. And so it is quite a peaceful, calming experience, I think, when people listen to the record, which is not the way the mountains are the majority of the time. You know, it's a wild and dangerous place, but it's also beautiful and inspiring, and you can have these incredible calm days when you can see right out, it feels like, for hundreds of miles. And I think there's something in that being within the mountains that is the sort of philosophy and the spirituality of her book, and is one of the most important chapters, I think, which kind of encompasses the whole meaning of what she's saying.
Journey into being where we walk. The meaning is revealed. Knowing and gifted from the mountain. Awakening.
It is a beautiful album. So, you know, thanks very much for being our guest today.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been really nice to chat to you both, obviously. Nan Shepherd enthusiast as well, so any excuse, it's great.
Yeah, too straight. It's a growing club.
Yeah.
Jenny Sturgeon's album, The Living Mountain, is out now. You can find out more information at our website, Jenny Sturgeon Music. That's all one word, jennysturgeonmusic.com. You'll also find details of her accompanying podcast series, which features conversations relating to The Living Mountain, and there's some fascinating stuff in that. Please get in touch with us and tell us where you listen to this. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. That's outofdoors, all one word, @bbc.co.uk. For myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham and Jenny Sturgeon, thanks for listening.